just in time, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. All right, let's see if we've got some people coming here. All right, I have a 1 minute after, so I'm going to go ahead and get started, and I'm sure people will continue to join as we go along. And welcome, everyone, to our third interview in the Bike Touring Bliss interview series. This is Elise Giddings from Cycle 9. And today, again, we've got another inspirational and entertaining story lined up. I just wanted to say I started this interview series because I'm interested in bike touring as a way of travel and as an adventure, and I love hearing these stories, so what a better way to spend a few hours in the winter months. And at the end of the end of the interview today, I've got a special surprise to let everyone know about, and I'll also let you know how to access the full set of interviews in the series. But for now, I'm excited tonight to be talking about a person who can really only be described as a true adventurer at heart. He came from a family that was one of the first to pioneer world adventure travel, and the family spirit definitely seems to have worn off. Raised in what he describes as a, quote, alternative lifestyle, he's become accustomed to living on the fringe of society. So apparently when he told his family about that he was about to embark on an off-road bike tour traversing over 34,000 kilometers across the entire North and South American continents, their response was, well, it's about time. And so with that, he set off with two friends for a couple-year journey, which then turned out to be almost twice as long as they had originally planned, and experienced the real heart of adventure travel at its best. And with that, welcome to Goat from Riding the Spine.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well. So, first of all, tell me about your name, because it's a very unusual name, and a lot of people, I think might wonder how you got that name.
Well, my name was given to me in third grade. It wasn't the name I was born with, but it stuck so immediately that it's just been my name ever since then. There's some speculation as to why I got the name. It wasn't because I have my facial hair or bare feet, because I didn't have facial hair at that point, and I hadn't decided to be a barefooter then. Best guess is that it has to do with climbing lots of things and willingness to eat strange things like vegetables.
So you got the name and it stuck ever since then.
Exactly. Yeah. So now, you know, everyone calls me Goat, and I don't even answer to my other names now.
Yeah. Those are long gone history.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, what inspired you to undertake this trip in the first place?
Well, the idea to follow the spine, which is, you know, the longest continuous mountain range in the world, goes through North and South America. It almost connects one long mountain range. Started because of the Great Divide Bike Trail, which is in, well, goes through Montana, Wyoming, so on down the Rocky Mountains, starting from Canada, going all the way to Mexico, created by the Adventure Cycling Association. And it's all off-road and crosses the divide like 30 times in, I don't remember how long it is, but anyway, I found out about that when it was new. I was in high school and was, you know, just excited by the idea of being able to tour and not do it on pavement. And so I was inspired, decided to do that trip one day, and planned to do it when I graduated from high school. But my friends who claimed to be interested all bailed, and I didn't really want to do it by myself, so I went to college instead. And there, fortunately, I met some crazier friends, and we pretty much from as soon as we met each other, Jacob and I have been dreaming about this bike trip, and very quickly it grew, because the question basically being, the mountains don't stop at the border, so why should we? And quickly went from just North America to, well, we might as well keep going. And so we dreamed about it for a few years, finished college and such, and flew to Alaska.
Wow. Sounds great. So it was you and Jacob and one other person, right?
Right. Yep. Myself, Jacob, and Sean. We were all, we met at UC Santa Cruz, and we all did every part of the trip. And there were several other people that joined us at various points. As many as five people were riding together in Peru, which is pretty exciting too. It's kind of like having a biker gang. We rolled into these small towns in the middle of nowhere. We literally filled the main street with our bikes. And anyway, it's kind of like the aliens had landed.
They hadn't seen many bike tours before you?
Well, yeah, definitely not. You know, our main mission was to avoid paved roads and follow the mountains. So we spent a lot of time on tiny little single track winding around in the middle of nowhere and on trails that dead ended and fording rivers and all that sort of thing. So when we did actually come upon towns, they were always really small, and often the only gringo tourist ever to arrive, let alone by bicycle coming in the back way.
Right. How did you find your route?
It was kind of trial and error sort of thing. A lot of asking questions and getting really bad directions. We would start by comparing satellite photos and the best maps we could get, which were sometimes non-existent and sometimes decent but 60 years old, and we would sort of try and connect the dots between the shaky little lines, because we knew that people lived in these places and that they had to get around. And so if we saw a trail that dead-ended, we'd look at the satellites and see if there was a huge river or a huge cliff there. And if there wasn't, we would generally assume that it went on to somewhere, and then we'd try and follow it. The other main method was getting names of little towns in blank spots on the map, and we would go to one of those little towns and then ask how to get to the next one. And people would look at us like we had two heads and then say, why the heck would you want to go to there? And no, don't worry about it. That's where we want to go. And they'd point us down a little road and tell us it was a terrible road and we should take paved road back to the main town. So on. And we just connect the dots between tiny little towns like that.
Yeah.
Problem being that there were no markers on these trails, and people, you know, knew their way between these towns, but had no idea how to give directions, tell us, you know, which tree we were supposed to turn at, or, you know, which dry creek bed we had to follow, and that sort of thing. So we ended up lost pretty frequently.
And that was just part of the adventure, I'm sure.
Absolutely. You know, we always ended up somewhere interesting, and that was really the reason we were out and about. Getting to these particular places was never really the goal.
Right. I should also mention for the listeners, on the left side of the screen, there is a little question and answer box. So if you have questions as we go along, type them in there, and they will show up on my screen. And I may hit some of them as we go, and then we'll also have some time at the towards the end of the hour. I will just go over questions that have been submitted, and we can, you know, see what you all have to say as well. So type in the question and answer little chat box on the left side if you want to ask any questions as we go. So let's see. You had three riders, and you guys were riding on Surly Big Dummy bikes. Is that right?
Well, when we started out, we were all riding bikes with extra cycles attached because Big Dummies didn't exist yet. And, you know, the trip was also inspired by the extra cycle, largely, because I tried to do a little dirt touring when I was in high school and was starting to imagine this trip, and realized really quickly that standard road touring panniers just don't work on single track. Your bike gets top heavy and you just, you know, can't control it, especially not with the amount of gear and weight that we would have to carry to do what we're imagining, especially when it became a world trip instead of just a U.S. trip. Fortunately, I came across the Xtracycle when they first came out. I was at a Friends of the River conference, and Kipchoge, one of the inventors of Xtracycle, was biking around with a kayak strapped to the side of his bike, and I saw it and immediately knew that I needed one of those, whatever it was, and it just fit too well with my lifestyle. I've never driven a car, but I need to carry a lot of things around a lot of the time, build things, whatever. So anyway, I've been riding an Xtracycle for about 10 years and knew that, well, because of the Xtracycle, that this trip was possible. So we all designed our bikes around Xtracycles to begin with, but we broke a fair number of them, and Xtracycle was always, you know, replaced them immediately, and we started talking about improvements and such. They eventually made us a prototype super heavy-duty version of the Xtracycle, which one of our riders rode from Mexico on down, which didn't break, no problems. And hopefully they're going to come out with that sometime soon. But the big dummy came out while we were on the road, and we talked to Surly, and they asked us to do R&D for them, basically. So they gave us a prototype of the big dummy, and we rode, one of our riders, that's Sean, rode the big dummy for 2.5 years, and again, it served impeccably, so I kind of proved the product for them, and we were pretty stoked on the support. My bike's custom and particularly strange. It has giant sand and snow tires and a frame built to accommodate those by a friend who's a frame builder in New York.
Wow. So you guys were, that sounds like the perfect beta testers for the big dummy. If it can survive that, it can survive any urban street.
Exactly, yeah. It was a nice fit, you know, for both Xtracycle and Surly. They got a real, real world test for their gear, and we got nice gear to use that could actually handle what we were up to. So,
yeah, for sure.
Couldn't really happen without.
Right. All right. So you guys started up in Alaska. It's essentially Prudhoe Bay. Is that the northernmost point you can go in Alaska?
Yeah, it's a town called Dead Horse, and it's basically where oil workers live for the 2 weeks that they're on working in the oil fields, and then they'll fly back to Texas and other places that are warmer for their 2 weeks off. And so there's really nothing there except machinery and dormitories, but it's right up there on the Arctic Ocean, and it's as far north as you can go by road. Point Barrow is slightly further north, but you can only get there overland in the winter when there's ice roads. And we decided those extra 100 miles weren't worth the pain and suffering that would entail.
Right. And you had some excitement pretty soon off the bat, isn't not too long after you started?
For sure. You know, we when we were flying up there, there were headlines all over all the newspapers in each airport we stopped at, and about a wolf that was attacking people. First one that had attacked a school teacher, and she had to take refuge in a porta potty, and then it hassled a motorcyclist and chased him, and then herded a whole busload of tourists into a tour bus. Anyway, so headlines were everywhere because that's not normal wolf behavior, so they're wondering if it's a rabid, what the problem was, and there might be one, there might be two of them. But anyway, this wolf attacking people was on our route because there's only one road, and so we kind of had to go right through there. The wolf was hanging out by the Arctic Circle, and the Arctic Circle campground for some reason. And so, you know, we kind of were joking. We were terrified, obviously, because we're on bicycles and a wolf, you know, well, how are we going to do to a wolf? And there's also huge bears and even the herbivores up there are so big that they can be pretty dangerous. Wolves, I don't know, moose and elk and such. So anyway, to try and ease that fear tension, we were joking about what we'd do if the wolf attacked. And Sean liked to pull out his shiny new knife and say, I'm going to shank it. If the wolf jumps me, I'm ready. Got my Rambo knife.
Okay.
And so, you know, that didn't really help, but it was a good joke. So we rode on. We started. It was about a week into our trip. We were getting close to this Arctic Circle, and we were a week's ride from anywhere. It was at first part of our trip. We had to carry 2 weeks' worth of food because it was that far between inhabited points. So, but right as we were approaching this wolf territory, we saw a truckload of oil workers headed the other way who slowed down just long enough to tell us that they'd just seen a wolf by the road and that we should be careful. We thanked them and wondered what we could possibly do to be careful. Anyway, we rode on because we didn't really have a choice, and we stopped for the obligatory photo op at the Arctic Circle. You know, those imaginary lines are important. And right there on the big sign that said, you're on the Arctic Circle, was a paper notice that said, problem wolf in area, stay in your car. Obviously, we didn't have the protection of our cars to deal with, so we just rode on and hoped that the wolf wouldn't attack. And we kind of pushed ourselves to ride as long as we possibly could that day to ideally get out of the range of the wolf because we didn't see it. And so we slept easily and woke up kind of excited and refreshed. And, like, passed that first scary test, we'll be good to go. And so the next day we were riding and kind of spread out a little more than we had been. Jacob was feeling like strong, having a particularly good day. Anyway, so he was about a mile ahead of us all, and we couldn't really see him. And as he was riding along, he heard a trucker coming up from behind, and this road was built only for truckers. So when you hear one of these giant, oversized trucks coming, you get out of their way, basically, because they're good drivers, but, you know, you just don't want to risk anything. And so he looked back to gauge the distance of this truck, and out of the corner of his eye, he saw something jump out of the bushes. So naturally, he did a double take and looked back, and sure enough, there was a wolf. And not only that, but it was chasing him. Now, they say that you're not supposed to run from wolves or bears or lions or, you know, many these predators that it gets them excited. But obviously, he was already moving, so he wasn't about to stop and let it catch up to him, you know. So he accelerated and started riding as fast as he could. It would be hopeless to try and outrun a wolf, but, you know, again, what else is he going to do? They can sustain, like, 40 miles an hour for hours.
Wow.
And so as he's riding, he remembers that he has bear spray, which is basically, like, oversized mace. But it's like a fire extinguisher-sized bottle of mace. Anyway, so he's digging around trying to get his pepper spray, but it's in his handlebar bag, and it has a safety, and it's in a case, and he's riding as fast as he can and fumbling and keeps looking back, and the wolf's getting closer and closer. You can, you know, I can see its teeth. You can see it drooling. Just and finally gets the thing out, and he's fumbling around trying to get the safety off and wondering if it's possibly going to work, and right then, the trucker, we'd completely forgotten about, hits the wolf, swerves to Miss Jacob, and just keeps going.
So, he, like, swerved off the road and hit the wolf with his truck and then managed
exactly.
to miss Jacob?
Exactly. And he didn't even slow down. He honk, wave, just swerved, hit the wolf, swerved back to Miss Jacob, and just kept right on going. Jacob stopped, you know, all shaken and adrenaline rushing and so on, and went back to check on the wolf sort of to see if all that was real, you know. seemed like might have been imagining it or something. And sure enough, it was the wolf, and it wasn't quite dead. And so he felt bad for it, you know, that it had died for him, you know, whatever, just following its carnivore's instincts. And so he went to try and put it out of its misery. And wolf necks are pretty thick and so on, so he's a little bit of work despite his shiny new knife. And so right then we ride up, and there's Jacob standing in a pool of blood with his knife in a wolf's neck. And, you know, we look at him with just, you know, astonished what could possibly be going on, you know. And he looks up and doesn't even miss a beat. He just said, "I shanked it." And, well, that was the end of it. It turns out that the wolf was young and was probably, its mother was poached, and so it probably never learned how to hunt. And that's why it was chasing us, because we seemed like easy prey. That's what the fish and wildlife people, they did an autopsy on it, said. So, anyway,
wow.
It's a pretty exciting way to begin our trip. Like, wow, this really is an adventure, I guess.
Holy cow, yeah, I mean, geez, it's not something that you, even when you're doing a lot of adventure travel, that's not the kind of thing that you come across very often.
No, exactly. Lone wolves are completely rare. You know, we were worried about bears up there, but we didn't have any problematic bear encounters. We saw lots of bears almost daily, and some of them grizzlies and so on, but they never seemed to pay us any mind, which was comforting.
Yeah, yeah. Jeez. Wow, so did it improve from there, or what happened next?
It calmed down a little bit, at least. Our only other scary or serious wildlife encounter in the North Country up there was with a bull moose, and we unwittingly camped in its pathway, and so it came and was kind of pissed off that we were blocking its way and in its territory, and was stomping and shuffling around our tent for a while. But I guess it decided we were harmless and went. By the time we poked our heads out of the tent to see what was going on, it was down in the lake eating, and all we saw was, you know, the classic horns come up out of the water and drain, you know, gallons of water off of them, and well, it munches some algae or whatever it is that it's eating off the bottom of the pond. You know, we headed out of Alaska about as quickly as we could to try and get into the Rocky Mountains, because we didn't quite reach into Alaska. So we crossed over into the Yukon Territory to Dawson City, which is the seat of the Yukon Gold Rush and still a pretty interesting place. And then we headed south through the kind of through relatively uneventful territory, except that we got to see the Northern Lights. And so we started riding at night, just so we could see the Northern Lights. But it's strange, because unless you're looking at the sky all the time, you don't know whether they're happening or not, because you don't hear them or anything. And so we may have missed a bunch of them, because we only figured out that the Northern Lights were happening because we were riding at night accidentally and noticed these strange reflections off of each other's helmets and kept looking around to see who was shining colored flashlights at us. And then finally figured out that we needed to look up, and what we saw was so amazing that we all stopped and lay down in the middle of the road and just stared at the sky for a couple hours.
Wow.
And then after that, like I say, we started riding at night every night so we wouldn't miss them if we could.
Yeah. Was it, were they bright enough to ride, like essentially as like a full moon?
Yeah, exactly. It was kind of like that. When they were really going off, you could definitely see like a full moon. We wouldn't use headlamps or anything. You know, where we ride, there generally isn't any danger of cars and stuff. So we risked running into things a little bit because it wasn't that bright out. But yeah, by and large, you could see everything you needed to see to avoid large obstacles and such.
Yeah. Wow. Hmm. So what time of year did you start? Was it in the springtime?
So we started in July. We would have liked to start a little bit earlier, but Jacob was teaching middle school, and we had to wait till the school year finished anyway. Because we started slightly late in the season, we got snow a bit quicker and earlier than we would have liked. And so our first snow hit in Canada, and then we were fully in winter by the time we got to Montana. I guess it was an early and heavy snow year, but by mid-October, and then for the next few months, we were biking and camping and everything in the snow, which makes mountain biking exponentially more difficult. So, you know, not only were we riding the Great Divide Trail, which is relatively difficult in some sections anyway, but we were trying to route find in the snow, which despite the amazing maps that the Venture Cycling Association puts out, they don't really account for. And then just riding the snow is physically problematic.
Did you have to walk a lot?
We did, especially on uphill stretches when it was loose. You know, if a car or a snowmobile, so a lot of those roads are logging and Forest Service roads, and so people go four-wheeling and stuff on them. And so if a car or a snowmobile had passed before us, it was usually compacted enough that we could get uphill and so on. But if it was a fresh trail, you kind of just spin out, and there isn't much you can do. And then when you're going downhill, it's kind of like skiing on a bike. You don't get to turn with the handlebars so much as lean and hope for the best. And sometimes your wheels get stuck in frozen ruts that are under the snow that you can't see, and all of a sudden you're, you know, completely sideways. But thanks to the amazing stability of the long-tail bicycle, we were able to do that. And I don't know, I might be because I had more skiing experience than the other guys or something, but I got kind of good at it and started to enjoy the long downhill stretches. So much so that in Montana, at one point I ended up getting like 2 or 3 hours ahead of the rest of the group and didn't realize that. So I stopped, you know, at dusk and figured they'd be along in a few minutes. So I sat down to wait, and the temperature started dropping. I didn't really think about it because my body was still kind of warm from biking, and I made the mistake of not changing my underclothes. I just threw a jacket on over it because I figured they'd be along soon and we'd ride to camp, and then I'd actually change my clothes. And minutes turned to hours, and it started to get dark, and finally Jacob came along and said that he hadn't seen Sean in hours. And so you know, we started going to disaster contingency kind of planning, like where we could find people with a snowmobile to go and look for them or something like that. And right as we were about to kind of like split up and try and do something like that, he came over the hill, and turns out his brakes had frozen solid and he'd been unable to unfreeze them. So he'd been riding the whole day without brakes, which meant that he crashed rather a lot. And so he was having kind of a horrible day and was covered with snow and so on. And it was obvious that we needed to stop right then, not only because it was now below zero, but it was dark. And so we'd noticed earlier that there seemed to be a cabin of some kind relatively close. So we went and rode through a broken fence and over to this cabin, which turned out to be an abandoned house that was about half demolished, and but fortunately had a supply of dry firewood and newspapers from the 70s. And so we lit a fire and, you know, settled in, tried to warm up. And so I was sitting next to this blazing fire, and I realized that my feet were getting frostbite. Now, I'd gotten frostbite once before, and so I knew the feeling. And I was like, how could that be happening? You know, I'm sitting next to this roaring fire. I'm wearing all my clothes. I'm even, you know, like wearing socks. And So I stood up to go try and put on more clothes and basically fell over because I was hypothermic, and, you know, when you're hypothermic, you... Fortunately, I wasn't so far advanced I didn't realize I was cold, but I lost all my motor skills and I couldn't talk. I tried to tell the other guys what was going on, and they tell me I was just sort of mumbling, and they couldn't understand what I was saying at all. And I guess at this point it was about minus 12, and so I went and put on all my clothes. Still didn't take off the wet undergarments, which is the cause of all this, but I put on all my layers and got in my sleeping bag, and the other guys boiled some water, put it in a water bottle, and put it in the bottom of my sleeping bag, and that did the trick. He got my body temperature up to speed and all, and made it through the night. But the next morning, I wasn't hypothermic anymore. In fact, I was feeling fine, except that my feet were a pretty serious case of second-degree frostbite, which means they had turned black, and I didn't lose that much flesh, but I had these huge, kind of like blisters, but the size of my whole foot, where the ice crystals in my thawing blood had kind of just shredded my tissue. And unfortunately, I didn't really have any choice but to ride on that for the next 2 or 3 days until we got to a town, and I made some slight footwear changes to, so that my feet would heal. And we decided not long after that to get out of the snow. At that point, we were in Colorado, and there was 3 feet of snow, and we just couldn't bike anymore and realized that it was just kind of silly. So we jumped out of the mountains for the first time on our trip and went down into Utah and then Arizona, which ended up being a spectacular choice because, a desert with a dusting of snow is incredibly gorgeous and there was no one around. So we got all these amazing slick rocking backcountry lines through that part of the world.
Yeah, that's a beautiful area for sure. So the you were wearing shorts. I've noticed you are you wearing shoes? I should say. I've noticed that you don't prefer to wear shoes.
So yeah, I don't wear shoes. I haven't worn shoes in more than 10 years. And except for I had to wear shoes for 2 months after that frostbite episode. In the snow there, I was wearing neoprene socks, which. Kind of like, wetsuit socks, but a little thinner. Mm-hmm. They make them for ski boot use, I guess. But, they worked fine down to about 0 degrees. Down to about, 20 degrees, I just go barefoot in the snow all day camping, no problem, as long as I keep the rest of my body warm. And then the neoprene socks worked great and probably would have worked when it was even colder, except that I'd had to hike on them so much that I wore holes in the bottom. And those holes, oddly enough, are right where I got my worst frostbite. And so I assume that's where the cold crept in and froze my feet. After this, I started carrying emergency footwear to try and make sure that didn't happen again. But I didn't wear shoes the rest of the trip. So.
Wow. And your feet just get used to it after not wearing shoes for so long?
Yeah, well, it actually only takes a few weeks before it's not painful and strange to be barefoot. And then after a few months, you adjust to it. And then, of course, after so many years, I have calluses and a thick sole, and I can pretty much, walk anywhere on anything without... Mm-hmm. A problem. It isn't like you lose feeling or anything. It's just, I don't know. Because part of the reason that I go barefoot is that I like to feel where I'm walking all the time and have that sort of connection to the ground and to the place. But anyway, my feet have certainly adapted.
Right, yeah. So you continued on down south and through Mexico?
Yeah, entered Mexico and Sonora and headed more or less directly for the Copper Canyon because we figured we didn't want to miss out on that. And we were right. It turned out to be one of the most spectacular parts of the trip. It's a system of seven canyons, all of which are deeper than the Grand Canyon, that makes up pretty much the whole state of Chihuahua, which is one of the biggest states in Mexico. And it's relatively unpopulated because it's, you know, such extreme geography. And the people who do live there are the Tarahumara Native American people, who are known for, among other things, not wearing shoes. But they run to get from one place to the next. It's just sort of the normal mode of transportation. And so these people just kind of run marathons on a daily basis just to get to the next village or, you know, go hunting or whatever it is. And they're shy and reclusive. They live in the canyons because they were pushed there by the Spaniards, and they were the only people in Mexico that didn't, you know, get conquered and subjugated because they managed to run into these canyons and escape. Anyway, so not only was it really beautiful, but we got some little glimpses of the Tarahumara culture and, you know, explore this pretty amazing area. It's not really the most bike-friendly zone, so we had to stick to four-wheel drive roads that had already, you know, been worked out by the people who lived there. And unfortunately, those roads were made primarily by narco traffickers, drug runners. And they were always friendly to us and such, but one night we were camped by the ford of a river, and these three trucks, two of them piled high with bales of what we assume was marijuana, came over the ridge driving really fast and proceeded to get stuck in the river about, I don't know, 100 yards from where we were camping. And all these guys jumped out of the truck and scattered with their bales of weed. And the third truck made it through the river, and so they piled it even higher and then hid the rest of it as best they could and then scattered. And right about then, another set of headlights came over the hills, and it turned out to be a military Hummer with a mounted machine gun, and they were chasing these guys with the weed. And so they hauled the drivers out of the trucks and harassed them and, you know, arrested them, I assume, and then towed their trucks out and then drove off. And we all kind of let out a collective sigh of relief and, like, man, I'm glad we didn't get involved in that. That was pretty intense. Went back to eating our dinner of oatmeal, and, you know, we're just sort of trying to process what we just watched, and we noticed some rustlings in the bushes. And, you know, we didn't think that anything of that. Lots of animals were out in the middle of nowhere until someone barked out in Spanish, of course, that we should put our hands up. And it was so surreal that my immediate response was to ask why. And so I did that in Spanish. And then they answered by cocking their machine guns, all eight or nine folks that had encircled us and crept up, now stood up with their machine guns locked and loaded at us. And so naturally we threw our arms in the air and started babbling in Spanish about how we didn't speak Spanish and that we were harmless gringo bicyclists and so on. And eventually their leader came forward. He was the oldest of the group at probably 20. And he was shaking, you know. He was so terrified and sweating bullets. You know, they obviously had assumed that we were somehow involved with the drug runners and maybe even camping out there to try and ambush the military. So they expected, you know, a firefight. Fortunately, no one had an itchy trigger finger, so we all lived to tell the tale, and they, you know, pretended to search us for a little while and then left us for the evening.
They were part of the drug running crowd, or they were military?
It was the military, and this is right before the kind of full-on war that's going on in parts of Mexico right now. And the new president of Mexico, well, he was new then, Calderon, had just started his policy of trying to burn all the marijuana fields he could find. And so he had the military out hiking through these zones, just burning fields, and they didn't. And so usually there wasn't any drug runners or whatever. They didn't run into anyone because people would see the military coming and just leave. But there was a very real possibility of ambushes and fights. And, you know, it's escalated into a war now, so that's what they were afraid of.
Right. So did you have access to news and things about what was going on when you were on your trip, or did you just find out these kinds of things later?
You know, we tried pretty hard to keep, you know, abreast of what was going on in the countries we were in. People always wanted to talk to us about current events in their small neck of the world, and you know, the internet is amazingly pervasive these days. We found, you know, internet cafes everywhere, even in really tiny towns. Sometimes towns, you know, with intermittent electricity would still have a dial-up connection somehow, and that's how we managed to keep up our website. You know, so we'd learn a little bit about what was going on in the world from the internet that way. But we were definitely kind of isolated, and, you know, or, you know, if we knew what was going on, it was what was going on in the country we were in, not necessarily anywhere else.
Right,
people had
yeah.
definitely warned us that things were tense and that there was military operations going on in the Copper Canyon when we were riding through. But, yeah, we didn't think there was really any reason for worry. And as it turned out, there wasn't really, but it was, we would have that one dangerous situation. You know, we interacted with people growing drugs, the drug runners, and the military all on separate occasions. And separate, and when they didn't think you were one or the other, they were always really friendly and helpful. but, you know, has potential for problems.
Right. I suppose with the bikes and things, maybe you looked unusual anyway, so.
Exactly.
Maybe
no,
they
the
didn't
bikes,
assume you were.
Yeah, the bikes go an amazingly long way towards, you know, defusing most any situation and piquing people's curiosity and, you know, just making it clear that we're neither normal tourists nor anything else that they're expecting. And the neat thing about traveling by bike is that bicycles are something that people relate to all over. You know, despite the poverty of any area, bicycles are a prevalent form of transportation, and so people would be excited to check out our weird bicycles and, you know, the amount of gear we could carry on them and all that sort of thing. So it was definitely
right.
a conversation starter.
Yeah.
Usually, when we arrived in one of these little towns, first people would be kind of afraid and standoffish, and then some little kid would come out, and that would break the ice. They realized we were harmless and friendly because we'd, you know, play with the kids or give them a bike ride or something, and then instantly the whole rest of the town would be there, and Jacob and Sean would slip off. Sean would go shopping, and Jacob would try and update the website, and I would be left to watch our bikes and answer questions, the same, you know, endless questions for,
right.
You know, the hardest part about it is that everyone asked the same question over and over, so it'd be the same series as each new group of people filtered through. And so you know, anyway. But the benefit of being spokesman like that is that I learned a lot more Spanish. I became, you know, pretty fluent relatively quickly. And the other guys speak excellent Spanish as well, but definitely without the fluidity and ease that I learned because I just had to use it so much, talk to so many different people.
Lots of practice.
Exactly.
Do you, so would you, you would resupply in these small towns? Did you, how did you get money along the way? Did you bring it with you or did you work along the way or how did you fund the trip?
So we worked beforehand, which is, you know, part of why we left so late because Jake was, you know, working as a teacher and so on, and saved up what we thought would be enough money for 2 years. And surprisingly enough, it actually was. Though that was thanks largely to the number of contributions we got through our website. We had a lot of people who very generously helped us out along the way. It wasn't usually worth our while to work in these places we were passing through just because the local wages are, you know, so scant compared to what you can earn in this country. You know, like a day's wage for a doctor or someone with a university education would be somewhere around $20, whereas, you know, I earn $20 an hour relatively easily here. So anyway, it just didn't really make sense for us to spend our time working. Though, you know, we helped people out sometimes or, you know, did a little bit of field work or built something. You know, it was more as like a friendship and goodwill kind of thing than, you know, trying to fund the trip. We had all our money in bank accounts with ATM cards. And again, thanks to modern world technology, you can use an ATM card pretty much anywhere in the world, not in these little towns, but we'd go through a large enough town every few weeks, and so we had a communal bank account that we would get money out of and, you know, buy food and supplies and stuff and carry the money, enough money with us for to last a couple weeks worth of rice and beans, which is pretty much what we ate, rice and beans and oatmeal, and, yeah, those things were usually available in these small towns because, you know, Latin America is pretty populated, and so these little towns have to be at least relatively self-sufficient. So in even the smallest population center, there's always somebody who's acting as a store and has something for sale. In Bolivia, which was the poorest and scarcest area we went through on the whole trip, we ended up living on llama jerky because that's what the locals eat, and that was the only thing that they had that they could spare and that was for sale sometimes. And, you know, so we ate a lot of llama jerky. But most of the time, there was a reasonable variety of food, or at least we could get the rice and beans we were looking for and some stuff to make it taste a little more interesting, chilies or onions or whatever vegetables and meat we could find.
Right. Something to add a little variety once in a while.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure. Let's see, we're getting close to the top of the hour, so I guess if you were going to tell one more story from your trip, which would you tell?
Just for some variety, talk a little bit about our kayak trip. So obviously we were on a bicycle trip. We were following the mountain ranges, but there's a place down where the isthmus of Central America hits South America that there are no roads, not even really any trails. There's a road that goes from north to south called the Inter-American or Pan-Americana Highway. And but there's a 100-mile gap through what they call the Darien Wilderness, or the Darien Gap, and it's the only place on these two continents where there's a mountain range that runs east to west instead of north to south. And it's also a jungle swamp, and none of those things would really have kept anyone from building roads through it because they do that in in Latin America. They build roads in truly amazing places. But it's also where the FARC and M19 guerrillas hang out. Those are the main guerrilla groups in Colombia. And though they, you know, Colombia is really safe now, actually. The recent president has managed to basically get rid of all guerrilla activity and so on. But their stronghold is still in this little region where people don't really live, and so that's where they can retreat to. And in any case, the upshot of all that is it's not a very good place for gringo tourists to be. And while you can get through overland, there's two trails, and we actually know someone who did it, another very interesting world traveler. We got there at the rainy season, and we basically would have had to canoe most of it. And so we decided that it would be safer and more fun to kayak between Panama and Colombia. And so we found some kayaks. Well, my dad had a contact in Panama City who was the only person in the country of Panama that has sea kayaks. So that was fortunate. And he let us buy three of them. Four of them, actually, there were four of us at the time, and gave a bunch of dire warnings. In fact, he wouldn't rent the kayaks to us because he thought we were going to die. So he gave us the kayaks, and we strapped our bicycles to them and paddled for 3 weeks. We went about 300 miles to the northernmost port in Colombia, a town called Turbo. But we got to kayak through an area called the San Blas Islands, also known as the Comarca Cuniala, which is an like a indigenous reservation in this country. They call them comarcas there. Basically, it's a semi-autonomous region of native peoples. And what's interesting about this comarca is that it's built up, made up of 365 islands in the Caribbean. About half, the first half of which is all protected by reefs, so totally gentle and incredibly gorgeous, you know, postcard beauty cartoon islands that are just a mound of sand with two coconut trees. And the 365 islands, that's habitable islands. There's even more, like little tiny islitas and reeflets and so on. And so we just island hopped and ate tropical fish and coconuts. We had to get permission from the tribal council of chiefs to go there, and fortunately we had a contact who was a native Kuna guy and also a sea kayaker. He worked for the guy who sold us the sea kayaks, and so we arranged an audience with the council of chiefs and my brother, who was with us at the time, and we decided was the best diplomat of the group. Went and talked to them and got a letter of safe passage and permission that we had to show to all the sub-chiefs, because every island, there wasn't just, you know, there were a lot of islands that were just like family islands, and so they wouldn't have a chief, but any island that was even a small village had its own headman. And we'd arrive the island shore, and the first thing that, you know, everyone would do, they wouldn't even really ask or even ask us questions. They'd just take us to the chief. And chief would always be this small old man with a huge smile on his face, sitting in a thatch building. They had these big meeting houses in every village where when there was, I don't know, they had these meetings once a week, even in some places, where everyone would get together and bring their hammock and string them up inside and sit around and talk about what was going on in town, solve disputes and whatever. But when they weren't being used like that, it was just the chief hanging out there, maybe a couple of his buddies, and they'd be smoking cigarettes and laughing and chatting, and we'd walk in and they'd, you know, do a double take and then call for someone who spoke Spanish, because most of them were old enough that they only spoke Kuna, and some younger man who'd been educated in Panama would come in and read our letter and then translate it to the chiefs, and then they'd always welcome us warmly and offer us that meeting house to stay in, and usually they'd kind of force us to stay in the meeting house and tell us we couldn't string up our hammocks under the coconut trees because the coconuts would fall on us, and they didn't want to be responsible for gringos being brained by coconuts. So, and, you know, sometimes they'd, the town, you know, the town was always fascinated by us, you know, what we were doing in boats without motors and, you know, just our whole way of being. And so they'd come and bring us food and chat and so on. The Kuniala is pretty interesting in that they use coconuts as their currency still to this day because it's really their only export except a small amount of tourism. And so you have to be really careful not to eat coconuts even on small islands because they're every little piece of property is somebody's family property and they're harvesting those coconuts and trading them for provisions to these merchant ships that come up from Colombia with rice and you know, things like that, luxury goods like Coca-Cola, and they go back completely full of coconuts. And so we always have to sort of seek people out to buy coconuts, which always entertained us, because then they'd go, you know, pick them off of the same tree we would have picked them off of, but they cost about 20 cents a piece, so we weren't too worried about it.
And that's an area that that not many outsiders go to? Like, there's not much tourism in that area?
Yeah, well, deep in the islands where we were, there isn't. On the outer edge, yacht tourists stop through on the way between the Panama Canal and Cartagena, Colombia, because it's super beautiful, but it's too difficult to navigate in a yacht in there amongst the reefs, and so there's very little tourism. There's really only this one company that does kayak tours there. And the Kuna are sort of ambivalent about, you know, developing tourism because, you know, the money is enticing, but they, you know, don't want to mess up their way of life. And it's pretty cool to talk to people and have them, you know, kind of straight out tell us that they have everything they need and are happy. And I can say that they're the most, like, well-fed and generally happy group of people I've ever seen, especially on a Comarca or Indian reservation. And one guy we talked to who was kind of a missionary, I guess, but he was a native Kuna guy, said that to us. He was like, you know, I don't have, you know, fancy electronics and stuff, but I have, you know, more food than I could want. I have a house and my own land and a boat, and I don't have to work that hard. It's like, why would I want anything else? I get to live here in this beautiful area. You know, I have to say we could see where he was going with that. But
yeah, for sure. That's just so different than the way most people react to life of, you know, being actually thankful and grateful for what you do have.
Yeah, it was pretty refreshing, pretty neat. I think, you know, it definitely had to do with the abundance that they did have there. You know, they're one of the few indigenous groups that wasn't pushed off their normal homeland into a reservation. They managed to hold on to the land they knew and lived in and have it turned into their comarca. So they had a better, you know, they understood how to subsist there, and it was possible to, you know, like a lot of the reservations in this country are the worst land in the country, and that's why Native people got pushed there. So anyway.
Right. Right. Huh. Interesting. So how do you put a long-tail bike on a sea kayak?
Well, two of our bikes were all one-piece long-tails, and two of them were exercycles that broke down. And the exercycles, we took off the rear frame bit and managed to jam it in the rear hatch of the sea kayak and then lashed the frames on behind the paddler on each boat, and then wheels in front of the paddler. The boats were extremely loaded down, and it was kind of a miraculous feat, really, to fit all our stuff in there. And our bikes were pretty ravaged by seawater after the 3 weeks.
Yeah.
We did everything we could to protect them, but after 3 weeks of being immersed in salt water, metal isn't very happy. So we spent, I think, about a full week in a hotel room in Colombia in this CB port town where they didn't care. The hotel room had a concrete floor and they didn't care that we were renting it as a workshop. We rented one to stay in and one to work on our bikes in, and we were just sitting there and sand rust off our bikes for hours and hours and, you know, try and reassemble them. I had to rebuild. We took apart some of the wheels. Like I had a roll-off hub, and so I unlaced my wheels completely so as to protect that expensive and delicate piece of equipment. Even though I actually asked Roloff, and they said that as long as I changed the oil afterwards, it should be fine. But I didn't want to risk it.
Did the other folks use internally geared humps as well?
No. So my bike's kind of an anomaly. We all started with matching bikes. They were all Surly Instigator frames with extra cycle free radical attachments, Fox 04 vanilla front forks, and homemade Jeff Jones style H-bars, and regular gearing. We actually had 2x8 gearing, so only 16 gears, because we realized that we didn't need the big ring on the front triple chain rings, because we were never trying to go fast. What we were trying to do was grind uphill with lots of weight. So
yeah.
We had the lowest granny gears we could get. The other guys rode that same setup more or less the whole way. We switched to a big dummy on one of the bikes and so on. But in Arizona, I made a new bike that I dreamed about while we were biking in the snow. That was sort of a cross between the Pugsley, which is Surly's snow and sand bike, and the Big Dummy, which is a one-piece long-tail bike. And it's a custom frame built by Traffic Cycles. But my bike was, you know, everything about it was weird. I had to run disc brakes. I ran an internal hub. I had these giant tires. I realized that as soon as I went to the big tires that I wasn't going to be able to get the parts for my bike anywhere in the world, so I might as well go for all the weird specialized parts I wanted. Whereas with the other bikes, I tried really hard to make them cross-compatible with pretty much anything. Like, you can get, you know, V-brakes anywhere in the world. And so,
mm-hmm.
you know, I tried to make everything as simple and robust, and, you know, we only used the sort of cheap, shoddy parts we could get in, say, rural Ecuador as a stopgap until we could get to a town and have real parts sent to us or brought down. But we did have to do that sometimes, especially derailleurs. Our gears really didn't, well, we just destroyed gears. We had to change our drivetrains about every 6 months. But in the Colombia and Ecuador section, we were in the tropics in the rainy season, which means mud. And so we rode in landslides and flash floods and deep mud all day, every day for months, and so that set of drivetrains only lasted about 3 months and wore out to the point where Jacob's gears were skipping. Like, the teeth were all so shark-finned that he couldn't get purchase in any gear, and I had to actually take his cassette and carve the spline out and flip all the cogs around, and so the chain was rubbing on the what had been the backside, which got less wear, so that we could get somewhere. And JJ had to ride with only two gears for about a week for similar.
Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah, amazing that you managed to do that, really. It was one of the steeper sections of our trip, too.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, I think I've hit a lot of the questions that came in so far, but if you guys have other questions, feel free to type them in and send them over. Let's see. There was one other question here was just about transporting the bikes from the beginning and the end to where you came from. Were you able to fly with them, or did you ship them, or how did you transport the bikes?
So we did fly with them. Flying into Prudhoe Bay in Alaska is actually surprisingly easy because all the oil workers work 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. There's flights twice a day in and out of Dead Horse, and they're always half empty, but I guess half full is enough revenue for them to fund them. But anyway, there's plenty of space, even though they're small, you know, like commuter-sized planes. And so they didn't even charge us extra to bring our bikes. At that point, we were all running exercycles, which means the frames broke down, and we could fit it all in one normal bike box, which made it easier. And then when we shipped the big dummy down to Mexico, we had huge problems. Sean had actually gone back to California to help his dad, who broken his leg or something like that for a little while, and then picked up the big dummy from Surly there and tried to fly down with it. And, well, it wasn't specifically against any of the rules. He basically had to ship it, and it got shipped to the wrong city, and he had to take a bus to anyway, it was just a nightmare. And when we, so because of that, he and Sean both elected not to bring their bikes back from the end of the trip. That we managed to sell them in Argentina, and well, they're pretty shot at that point anyway, so it wasn't a big loss. I was too attached to my weird bike to leave it behind. It's one of a kind. But anyway, so I brought it back, but I left pretty much everything except the frame, and managed to ship it on the airlines, but I got charged extra baggage fees three different times, which was kind of a pain, but...
Yeah. Well, I think that's the way it is these days on the airlines.
So it seems, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So when did you end your trip? How long ago was that?
We ended in February, early February, so it's getting close to a year now.
Yeah. So are you going to do another one soon, or are you just hanging out? What are you up to now?
Well, Jacob's working on the book about the trip, theoretically. Sean maybe too. They're more of the writers of the group. We're dreaming, Jacob and I are at least. I'm not sure Sean wants to travel with us for a little while. Anyway, he's actually on his way to India, I think, to bike ride a motorcycle around India for a while. But Jacob and I are fixing to sea kayak around Papua New Guinea. So that's the trip we're dreaming about at the moment. It's, you know, only a trip, but still pretty wild. So.
Yeah, for sure. I would say so. Yeah, so any final words from your trip? Did you... when you got to the end, did you feel different than when you started, or was it just one big adventure?
You know, we were traveling for so long that it just became, you know, it's a way of life. And, you know, anything to learn isn't really an epiphany. It's something you sort of internalize from interacting with so many people. So much, you know, it's our life so much so that on the last day, I almost didn't believe that it was the last day until, well, we saw the ocean, and it was honestly kind of anticlimactic at that point, kind of at a loss for what to do, so much so that I actually turned around and started riding north, but
yeah.
My bike didn't cooperate, and the Surly kindly sent me all the parts I needed to fix it. Customs wouldn't let me have them. And so I got stuck in Argentina for 4 months and got to sort of ease myself back into sedentary society that way by doing it in a different country, and then eventually gave up on ever getting my parts out of customs and flew back here.
Yeah, I would imagine the reentry would be kind of strange, so maybe that was a good way to do it.
Yeah, I think it helped ease it a little bit for me. Still pretty bizarre. Not only speaking English all the time, but just, you know, culture shock of all sorts.
Yeah, no doubt. For sure. Well, great. Well, thank you so much for doing the interview. I hope everyone out there has enjoyed the interview. This is the third one we've done in the Bike Touring Bliss series. And I've got a couple more planned for after the holidays, so stay tuned to your email inboxes if you want to see what's coming up. We're going to take a break here for the whole December season. If you want to see the or hear the interviews you missed, you can click on the link on the webpage on the left. There's a link for Get Bike Touring Bliss Audios, and that'll tell you how you can do that. There's also a link there to the Riding the Spine webpage, where they have tons of great photos, and their journal is really interesting to read through. So definitely, if you have not been over there, it's worth going over there and browsing it and checking out some of the awesome photos and things that they've got there. I did say at the beginning of the call I was going to tell you about a little surprise we've got going just for the listeners of Bike Touring Bliss. I'm going to offer a special deal on a long-haul trucker, which is the probably the most popular touring bike in the world, or at least in the United States, also made by Surly, who you guys used pretty much your whole way. So it's the long-haul truckers. Yeah, it's the trucker's sort of the most comfortable, durable, and, you know, sort of built-to-last touring bike out there, and they sell super well in our store. We have a store here in Carrboro, North Carolina. So if you've been thinking about getting set up for touring, and that's you should check out the deal on it by just clicking on the button on the left where it says long haul deal, or you can also see it at biketouringbliss.lht.html. So yes, that's about it for tonight. Thank you guys all, and thank you Goat so much for joining me, and I've really had a great time talking to you.
All right, me too. Thanks a lot.
And watch your email inbox, and you'll see what's coming up next. Thanks, everyone, and we'll see you next time.
The moderator has left the conference.